Hey, Matt Rothschild here, and welcome to another episode of the Wisconsin Forward podcast on the Civic Media Network. Today, we're going to be discussing the huge issue of our time, how to combat Trump and authoritarianism right here in the United States. For answers to this crucial question, we first go to leading scholars of authoritarianism, including Ruth Ben-Ghiat of NYU, author of Strong Men, and Yale's Timothy Snyder, author of On Tyranny, and Harvard's Stephen Levitsky, co-author of How Democracies Die. I've taken excerpts from recent interviews I found with them online, and I think you'll appreciate them. Then I talk with Dave Zirin of The Nation and The Progressive Magazine, and after that, I bring you two folks you probably know from the Civic Media Radio Network, Trygve Olson of The Lincoln Project, and Dom Salvia. One of the wisest voices on Trump and authoritarianism is NYU historian Ruth Ben-Ghiat, the author of Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present, which I just read recently. In it, she writes, pro-democracy movements that claim the mantle of moral authority and show care and solidarity in the face of plunder and violence can have an impact. In fact, even a relatively tiny percentage of the population, often just 3.5%, according to the political scientist Erica Chenoweth's study of successful civil resistance movements, can make a difference if they mobilize on behalf of democratic values in situations of tyranny. Creating a big tent opposition movement, she writes, that includes progressive faith traditions and organized labor, two sectors of civil society that privilege values-guided action, would be key. Individuals can refuse to betray others, deciding not to stay silent and hide away as rights vanish and abuses are perpetrated. As some people disappear, being visible on behalf of others becomes even more important. She continues, so does having conversations with family and community members who still support Trump and explicitly raising with them questions of dignity and decency and the betrayal of national and self-interest by this administration. As the government paralysis deepens and affects everyday life, these conversations will likely become easier. Each time we show solidarity with others, she concluded, or support those who are protecting the rule of law, helping the targeted, or exposing the lies and the corruption, we are standing up for democratic values of justice, accountability, equality, and more. In doing so, we model the behaviors the authoritarian state wants us to abandon. Joining with others, we transform our individual righteous indignation into a potent moral force for good. And here's Ruth Ben-Ghiat in her own voice talking recently on the David Pakman Show.
I think, one of the things that strong men do, they try and wreck what I call horizontal bonds, individuals' bonds with each other, with their communities. And what they want is the mass and the leader. Everybody's loyal only to the leader and they're adulating the leader, right? Mm. And so one thing that has allowed people to get through difficult times is communities, is networks, is relationships. And so this is a good time to embed yourself more into your community, to perhaps repair relationships with your family members or others. And that includes people who you haven't been able to speak to because of political things. Maybe they've been turned against everyone and against logic by disinformation. As the fallout from these policies becomes more clear, that's an opportunity for everyone to go in there and try and speak to these family members or community members or friends, because it's going to become more obvious that MAGA is not about making the nation great again. It's about ruining the nation.
Harvard professor Stephen Levitsky, the co-author of the really important book, How Democracies Die, picks up on this idea that we simply must get involved and join one organization or another, whichever one moves us. Here he is speaking on the Daily Blast at the New Republic with Greg Sargent.
People have to be engaged, and they have to be engaged in person, not just online. So there's no single strategy. There's no single organization. There's no single movement. There's no single cause. But it's incredibly important that people be involved, that they speak out, whatever the issue is that they care about. And there are 200 that one could think of. People need to join organizations, attend protests, write letters to their congresspeople.
Another expert on authoritarianism is Timothy Snyder. famous for writing On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. In that book, he writes, "The lesson is that our natural fear and grief must not enable the destruction of our institutions. Courage does not mean not fearing," he writes, "or not grieving. It does mean recognizing and resisting right away." And the 20th lesson of his 20 lessons is simple. Be as courageous as you can be. Here's Timothy Snyder in his own words, speaking to Rachel Maddow.
Number one, we should be aware that movements within this country, like the civil rights movement, and movements outside of this country, pro-democracy movements, regularly succeed. They regularly are in moments like this, troughs like this, valleys like this, where it feels terrible, and yet nevertheless they can succeed. The second thing to remember is that this is how they want to make you feel. They want to make you feel alone. They want to make you feel powerless. They want to make you feel overwhelmed by the airplanes in the sky and by the angles of the photos of Trump and by the gestures of the Elon Musk makes and so on. They want to make you feel that way. So catch yourself before you do. And the third thing is, if you act, especially if you act with other people you admire who you think are doing good things, you're going to feel better. If you do the little things that you can do, you can catch yourself before you start being dismayed.
With me now on the Wisconsin Forward podcast is Dave Zirin, a columnist for The Nation and The Progressive, and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Dave Zirin's been one of the boldest voices out of the gate resisting Trump and the authoritarianism that Trump has ushered in. Welcome to the Wisconsin Forward podcast, Dave Zirin.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Matt.
How do we really combat this authoritarianism that we're facing today?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people have said, well, we don't really have an answer for what to do. And I don't think that's correct. I think we do have some readily available answers right in front of us. I mean, first and foremost, I think we have to accept the cliche, and I'm going to beat this cliche to death. I don't even care, that no one will save us but us. I mean, if nothing else, we've seen over the last several months that the Democratic Party is not going to save us. These white shoe law firms are not going to save us. The university systems are not going to save us. Everything that we've sort of depended on as a kind of center liberal framework for how we think America is run is surrendering left and right. And I think we have to understand that there's a difference between compliance and complicity. Some of these institutions, and I'll use the mayor of D.C., Muriel Bowser, are fearfully complying with the Trump administration because D.C. has such little power relative to Congress. And there's real fears that home rule will just be stripped away from us. Yet other forces, and I'll throw Chuck Schumer on this, I'll throw the administration of Columbia University on this, are complicit with the Trump-Musk plan because they like enough of it that they're willing to surrender our freedoms, even though they're doing it without any sort of democratic way to challenge the fact that they're doing so. They're acting authoritarian as well in speaking for us about what we are willing to surrender.
Is it that they like it, or they're just cowards? The law firm's a coward, like Columbia's a coward.
You see, I don't buy the coward framework. I do in some cases, make no mistake about it. But if you're this law firm, if you're Paul Weiss, if you are also looking at the fact that if I don't get in good with Trump, I can't get any of the tech billionaire clients that I may have gotten in years before because they are clearly standing as one with Trump and they wouldn't dare anger Trump by getting Weiss and hiring them on. To use another example on this, I also think that, you know, their need to be able to get into government institutions and do things like that. I mean, they sold the hell out. That's what Weiss did. As far as Columbia University, there were so many avenues for them to resist what Trump is doing. They are refusing to do so for the simple reason that they agree. You know, they want these unruly anti-Zionist students, including the Jewish ones, to be literally not just kicked off the campus, but criminalized so it never happens again. So they're willing to trade the fact that they are destroying one of the great brands in higher education if it means getting these students off their campus and getting this kind of activism off their campuses. I mean, look, I'm from the neighborhood where Columbia University is, and it's long been a cliche that they're basically a real estate hedge fund where people are just go to class. Mm-hmm. You know, where do you go to class? I don't go to class at Columbia. I go to class at the real estate hedge fund.
Right.
So that's the driving interest for them. And Schumer, my God, no, Schumer, I think, is such a staunch anti-Palestinian. I mean, it all comes back to Palestine and who in power in the Jewish community is willing to weaponize our pain and our history to shred civil rights, and who is saying not in our name. That's the biggest, one of the most important splits happening right now. But all that's a prelude to say, and I know that was long, that what we have to start doing, if those of us who can, those of us who for now are safe, and believe me, I'm very much emphasizing that for now part, is we need to act in a spirit of noncompliance. We need to not agree with what is happening right now. We need to stand up for it, to it, whenever we can. And noncompliance is an incredibly effective action in the face of fascism historically, particularly in the very early days.
And what would that mean, noncompliance, for someone who's listening to this podcast and who agrees with us about the danger that Trump is posing and the need not to comply? How do you not comply?
Well, there are a lot of ways to not comply. I mean, first and foremost, if you have a child who goes to a school, you check with that school to make sure that they have a mechanism in place if ICE comes calling, if there's a parental network you can be a part of. Or in your neighborhood, if you have an organization like we have one here called Casa de Maryland, most places have now immigrant services organizations, is do you have a network of some kind, some sort of emergency network where if ICE does come a calling, people can go out there and do things that are completely legal, like videotape them, like ask to see warrants, like ask to see their faces, like ask to see badge numbers, and getting all of this stuff on tape. What we're seeing is that often that causes them to scurry away as opposed to going through their arrests. I mean, making sure people know their rights, even though Trump has such little respect for those rights, as we see. So that's on the question of immigration. I mean, and more noncompliance can also mean everyday life. You know, like try to find out in your community how you can actually support transgender youth instead of closing your eyes while this exterminationist policy towards them comes out of Washington. You know, there are ways to practice noncompliance. And I think the most important thing is to literally just look right in front of your face at your community, find out who's organizing, and work with them, because we can't exist siloed off from one another right now. Our ability to come together collectively is essential to everything I'm talking about, as well as essential to effective noncompliance. And just the last thing to say about that is we don't have a national anti-fascist party or movement in this country. That really is going to have to be built, but we can't sit around and wait for it. Like, no one's going to save us but us.
And that's like the old June Jordan line, we are the people we've been waiting for. And I can see elements of a national anti-fascist movement here and there. It's not a united, coordinated movement yet, but I think the seeds are there. And actually the shoots are coming out of the ground, and you've been helpful in cultivating that too. What hope do you have ultimately that pro-democracy forces, anti-fascist forces are going to succeed? You and I are both old students of Howard Zinn, the author of A People's History of the United States, who had an understanding that people, if we organize, will ultimately succeed. Where does your hope reside on that?
Well, I think it's so interesting that one of the things we have to know about Howard Zinn, and I'm writing a book about Zinn right now, so I'm thinking about this stuff all the time, is that he lived through some pretty difficult times himself that he didn't really talk about, like the McCarthyite period in New York City from 1945 till 1955, before he went to teach in Spelman in Atlanta, Georgia. Zinn didn't really write about those days, you know, in part because they were so incredibly trying and difficult, like getting accosted by FBI on the streets you know, sounds very familiar to today. That happened to him multiple times during that period. Going to the Paul Robeson concert in Peekskill and having his car smashed up while his baby was in the back seat. You know, these were traumatic experiences. But what Howard did was he wasn't Pollyanna-ish. He wasn't there's a brighter day tomorrow. He took his politics and his, you know, optimistic politics as being rooted in history. And frankly, I think that's our best guide. We're very bad at teaching history in this country. We need to learn about how people resisted in different situations because it is not a cookie cutter. I'm very frustrated with people who have a checklist and say, well, Nazi Germany did this and we haven't done this. And it's just like that doesn't matter. That part doesn't matter. The basic questions that matter are things like due process and the ability to express yourself democratically in a country where that's increasingly going away. Until it goes away, we need to read, we need to talk, we need to know our history, because that can be a guide for us for action.
Absolutely. And we need to know, as you point out, that there have been other tough times here in U.S. history where pro-democracy forces were under assault, and we made it through. But we don't make it through thinking it's going to happen without us.
I'm hoping that we win. And so what I just said, but I feel like I'd rather ask that question and be prepared than to have it happen and for us to be caught by our short hairs.
How bad do you think it could get?
I mean, again, when you look at history, I mean, you see how bad it can get. You know, at minimum, martial law, the end of constitutional protections, we would probably still have showcase elections where people have to bring their passport to vote. Just, you know, complete facade of democracy without a pro-democracy movement. I think if we can rile people up, and it's got to be, I think strikes are so important because of the dangers of going into the streets in this climate. So I was heartened. I know it's such a small thing, but I was heartened when the student from Tufts was kidnapped, abducted right off the streets. Her name was Rumeysa Ozturk. It's so important to say her name. That her union, SEIU Local 509, immediately put out a statement. And I hope and I think that that's inspiring other people in unions to put out statements as well, or to pressure their union to put out statements.
And let's remember why, or the reason that the Trump administration kidnapped her. Here, this is a Turkish student here on a valid student visa, a doctoral student at Tufts, one of the great universities.
Scholar.
Yeah, a Fulbright scholar who had signed on to an op-ed saying the Tufts should acknowledge the Palestinian genocide and divest itself from companies with ties to Israel. And for that, she was nabbed. I mean, this is the country we're living in right now.
Yeah, it's astounding. They are trying to change even the pretense of there being an American experiment. They're done with that. They want a new experiment, an experiment built on our backs. So, you know, we're going to have to figure out if we're going to make it easy for them or not. And I think we have the chance to do better than this.
Yeah, we can't make it easier for them. We've got to stand up and make it as tough as possible and defend our democracy. Dave Zirin, thanks again so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
With me now is Trygve Olson, senior advisor to the Lincoln Project and a regular guest on the Todd Albaugh Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Trygve, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, Matt.
Well, I thought you were just the guy to have on. You know, you've written a lot about how we defend democracy and resist authoritarianism, but things are getting bad fast here in the United States. So how do we get out of this mess we're in and save democracy in America?
Well, I think there's a few things that we have to think about. You know, from my work around the world, there's sort of always this discussion about something called critical mass, which is the point where those who are fighting for democracy become self-sustaining and ultimately, you know, cracks the brittleness of the authoritarian. You know, Donald Trump is kind of in this period and his autocratic enablers. You know, the first step was gaining power. The second step is establishing control. And the third is then maintaining total power. you know, they are receiving pushback. I wish that there was more pushback. Certainly the judiciary and judges are standing up to them. I think governors of some states are. The key in this really is, you know, we need the masses to be focused on doing whatever they can themselves. And, you know, I hear a lot of people on the left talking about, in the punditry class, talking about the next elections in the 2026 congressional cycle. And I think it's kind of navel-gazing at this point, because the question that I would ask people is, have you seen anything from Donald Trump and his enablers and Elon Musk that would suggest that they're going to hand power over, any power that they've accumulated, and they control Congress right now, to people that are going to hold them accountable?
Well, that is kind of a bracing suggestion that they would either fix the elections in 2026 or cancel them. Is that what you're thinking they might do?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to. I think trying to ascertain or gauge or guess about what the mechanisms will be, at a minimum, I think, you know, I mean, Elon Musk could flood the zone with even more money than he has previously. I think over the, you know, the next 18 months, you may see, if you're seeing the assault you're seeing on the judiciary and on the agencies, eventually you would assume that you're going to start seeing that on mechanisms of elections and certainly on the press. So what I am saying is the elections are going to happen one way or the other, whether they're free or fair or not is really another question. But for the time being, those who are on the pro-democracy side need to be focused on how do we beef up, how do we protect the guardrails of American democracy that aren't currently under assault, and how do we defend the ones that are? You know, part of fighting autocrats is staying a step ahead of them. I also think that if you think about Donald Trump's relationship with the Republican Party, and quite frankly, with the United States now, it's an abusive relationship. It has all the cycles of abuse. It just as it would in an interpersonal relationship. I mean, you look at Lindsey Graham or Marco Rubio, right? Like they are abused by Donald Trump. And there is that whole cycle. I mean, do you remember on January 6th when Marco and Lindsey were standing on the floor of the Senate saying, never again, count us out?
I'm off the train, Lindsey Graham said. I'm off the Trump train.
I'm off the train. And where is Lindsey Graham now, right? He keeps going back to the abuser. I think that's true of Trump supporters to a degree, right? Like 10% of Wisconsin jobs are at peril with the tariffs. Those people are being abused by Donald Trump, right? Like they gave their support. He wanted their support. He took their support. Now he's sticking it to them.
And how do we bring some of those folks around, Trigvi? On one civic media show, and it might have been Todd's show, there was a progressive farmer from the Midwest who was surrounded by Trump supporters. And he said, you know, it's easier for me to convince people that they were lied to by Trump than for them just to concede that they were wrong, flat out wrong, and made a mistake in voting for him.
100%. And well, do you get somebody to leave? All of us have had an experience, I'm sure, unfortunately, at some point with somebody that we know and care about who's in an abusive relationship, right? Like, you don't get out of it by saying they're a terrible person. You get out of it by getting them to figure out the reasons why they need to get out. And a lot of that is about asking questions. It's not about arguing with them. It's not about, you know, giving them facts, or it's helping lead them to see within themselves what's happening. And it's about getting them to take small steps. And, you know, one of the things, I haven't really talked about it ever on Civic, but one of the things that I do is I work with, through the Lincoln Democracy Institute, a global expert on micro behaviors, and she does a lot of stuff with abuse, people who are abused. It's about getting them to take small steps away from Trump, you know? And that could be as simple as, hey, let's go to this meeting about how tariffs are going to impact things, or take a look at this article. I'd really like your thoughts on it. And not, one that's over the top on Trump, but maybe something that's just about the economics in the state of Wisconsin.
I've all along thought that it's important to keep communications open with people in our social circles who, voted for Trump and not write them off. I know there's been a bunch of people after the election who said, I'm done. I'm done with these folks. I'm unfriending them on Facebook. I never want to see them again.
Right.
First of all, I think it's bad politics. And I also don't think it's great for human relations, but especially on the political front. I mean, we got to bring some of those folks over if we're going to, you know, save our democracy here. And so part of it is maintaining a decent relationship, listening to them, and taking a couple of these micro steps that you're suggesting, because otherwise we're going to push them even further into Trump's hands in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually been working on writing some of this stuff up. And, one of the things about Trump people, I write this, what are you trying to do? Disrupt the emotional and psychological certainty that keeps them locked in. Create moments of doubt that force them to reflect. Give them an off-ramp that doesn't feel like defeat.
Right.
To the point of the farmer that you're talking about. Reinforce their values while showing how Trump contradicts them. Make them see Trump's weakness, not his flaws.
It's kind of deprogramming them from the cult in a way.
Well, I mean, the key thing is, first of all, you never shame someone out of their beliefs. You can only get them to look back at the beliefs they held with shame. Second of all, you have to figure out how you give them a safe space in which to be communicating, right? None of us likes to be lectured to. None of us likes to be made to feel stupid.
Right.
And anything that you're doing that causes them to feel that way. So, you need to clarify, you need to contrast, and you need to connect to them. Become the trusted person that they can go to when they're questioning. Once you are that, you need to shift and contrast and reinforce. So give them not about Trump, but things that reinforce the concerns that they're feeling that are related to Trump. Give them space to reflect, reveal, and process, mm-hmm. always. Decouple from Trump, reframe it about something broader, America, Wisconsin values, the community, other things that they care about, and start planting seeds of doubt, and then help them reclaim, redirect, and release their identity. Because right now, think about how many people we all know whose identity is closely tied to their politics into things that have nothing to do with politics, right? I mean, I say on Todd's show all the time, the thing that's breaking Wisconsin is we're no longer wearing green and gold on things like UW system or public education or conservation and those kinds of partnerships. We've suddenly become a place where everybody wears a red or blue hat. That is how autocratic actors infect. I mean, when you go to a country like Putin's Russia, you can feel elements of Putin inside every element of society. And that's what Donald Trump, to a degree, is trying to do. He shows up at all the football games. Like, he's omnipotent.
And getting back to your point about guardrails, how do we protect the guardrails that exist and those that are under assault right now, like due process? Due process seems to be going out the window if you're an immigrant with, even if you have a green card, it seems. So,
right.
What should someone do who's outraged by that?
I mean, as that one judge pointed out, there were Nazis that were deported in World War II who were given more rights than these guys,
oof.
Right? Like, that's crazy. I don't like the process that Elon Musk and Donald Trump are using, which is the whole reason I left the Republican Party and have a beef with Donald Trump. They think rules are for suckers, literally. Right. No one wants to see criminals who've illegally entered the country wandering our streets. But you don't just start putting people on military aircraft and flying them out and defying judges' orders.
Yeah, I mean, that was really brazen. And I think there's going to be more brazenness from Trump and more disobeying judges' orders. The old line from Stalin was, how many divisions does the Pope have? I mean, the Pope doesn't have any military force. Who's going to stop Stalin? The Pope can't invade the Soviet Union and prevent Stalin from doing what he wants. I mean, how many divisions does John Roberts have, and how many divisions does the Congress have if they had a spine and there was opposition there? So
I would have a counter to that, having spent a lot of time. Stalin is right. How many divisions does the Pope have? But Pope John Paul, probably more even than Reagan or Thatcher, was responsible for the fall of the Berlin Wall and ultimately the implosion of the Soviet Union. That soft moral authority and power resides with people.
Can I just have your vision a little bit of a timeline where we're going? How bad can it get? I mean, my worst fear is tanks in the street, canceling elections, tanks in the street, Insurrection Act, going full throttle fascism. What is?
Can it get that bad?
Yeah.
I mean, the short answer is, yeah, it probably can get that bad. Is it going to get that bad? You know, I'm an optimist, and honestly, I learned that lesson over and over again. But I'll tell you a story, and maybe this is a good place to leave it. Back in 1999, do you remember? You remember when Serbia was going on?
Yeah.
Those guys, Slobodan Milosevic.
Sure.
Eventually, during the Clinton era, we bombed them and whatever. I was one of the last people in Serbia with just a standard U.S. passport. Mm. And I was there to work with college kids, basically, students. They were the student parliament. They had like a national parliament. I don't know what it would be similar to. But they had been out protesting Milosevic, and they were getting their heads beat in, and I worked with these guys from Harvard who were the leading experts on nonviolent resistance, and what I knew was how to get young people mobilized. And we went in and we trained these guys, and I got on an airplane after 2 weeks to fly out of Belgrade, and I thought to myself, this place is never going to change. Those kids, they're well-intentioned, but like, this just there's no way. And literally 16 months later, I was sitting in an apartment in Vilnius, Lithuania, watching CNN with tears streaming down my face as those kids took Milosevic down through peaceful, nonviolent resistance, millions of them on the streets. And I learned through that it can happen fast. When the power of people and their desire for freedom truly takes hold, their willingness to stand up is incredible. Passivity and silence are the autocrat's friend, and they instill that through fear. You know, long ago, in one of the most important moments in American history, Franklin Roosevelt said, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." Mm-hmm. That is truly the moment we are in. This is our moment where we need leaders and people who will stand up. People have to not be afraid. That's how you fight it.
We've got to resist passivity and silence. We can't be silent. I think that's great advice, Trygve Olsen. Thanks so much for being my guest on this Wisconsin Forward podcast.
You are very welcome.
Now I'm joined by Dom Salvia, host of the Dom Salvia Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Dom, I wanted your views on this issue of how we get past this period of Donald Trump and authoritarianism. What do we need to do? How are we going to get through this?
Thanks, Batman. Well, there's a lot going on, right? And you know, my initial reaction to everything is always pushback. It's always the pushback, and that's just my natural reaction. But I think there's a couple specific ways to deal with this. Number one, you know, find your core principles and stand on those things. And for me, it's truth. It's reality. It's the things we know, you know. And when we get administration officials trying to spin to us and lie to us specifically, when we know we have the facts in front of us, I think we stand up and we shout from the rooftops, "No, you're absolutely wrong." And I think we have to, in that same vein, compel our elected officials to do that for us. They are our representatives. And those are the ones that are supposed to represent us in Congress, in the Senate, and we got to get on them. We've seen some of the action. We've seen some folks going out to these town halls. We know right now the reaction of Republicans is, well, we're not having great luck at these town halls, so let's stop doing town halls. You know, those kinds of things. Or we hear, oh, they're just you know, paid agitators, that kind of thing. Well, that's not the case. I mean, these folks are getting hurt by this administration, and they're showing up. They're showing up, and they're pushing back. Number two, a sense of humor. I mean, I know these are tough times, but you know, we gotta find the humor and the fun in them. They're very serious at times, but we can't cry all the time. Sometimes you gotta laugh. And number three, we mock. I'm a big fan of the mock. When you mock these folks, it shows, you know, you mock the bully. Or, you know, you can certainly punch the bully back. And I get that rhetorically speaking. But when you mock them, oh, man, it just drives them absolutely nuts. They get off their game. Showing up, standing up, fighting back, and, of course, having a sense of humor and mocking the hell out of them.
Well, that's how we'll get through. Yeah. That's great advice from Dom Salvia, host of the Dom Salvia Show. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Wisconsin Forward Podcast. My next episode will be about money and politics in Wisconsin. What did we learn from the latest Wisconsin Supreme Court race? And how do we solve this problem of enormous, obscene amounts of money in our political system?